From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. By the time he was 11 years old, Eric Weiss was famous for unlocking the door of every store in his town over the course of one night. He later became Harry Houdini, perhaps the best-known magician and escape artist ever. He was also a shameless showman and a bit of a smart aleck. Here is the only known recording of his voice, introducing a new escape act in 1914.
Ladies and gentlemen, I take great pleasure in introducing my latest invention, the water torture cell.
The water torture cell. A new exhibit at the Bremen Museum tells both the famous and little-known stories from Houdini's life. Magician David London curated the show. David, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Houdini, what a life. I mean, he was born, Eric Weiss, in Hungary in 1874, the son of a not entirely successful rabbi, I guess. And that's when and where our first Houdini legend unfolds. Tell us about the dueling rabbi.
Sure. Well, actually, I think he was fairly successful in Budapest as a rabbi. He became less successful once he arrived in America. In fact, Houdini's father arrived to America one year before the rest of the Weiss family joined him. The Houdini's own story, deemed plausible by experts, is that his father was challenged to a duel in which he accidentally killed the man he was dueling with, who turned out to be a nobleman, and Houdini's father had to flee Budapest, which he seemingly did so with the help of the Rothschild family.
But that does not sound entirely plausible.
It's entirely plausible. Dueling was a common form of resolving conflict in Budapest at the time. His father was well connected to the elite in Hungary, so it was possible that he knew the Rothschilds, and he had to get out of there to get out of Dodge.
Okay, so I take it back. Sorry, Houdini's legacy. The exhibit at the Bremen brings visitors on that same journey as the family emigrates, eventually landing in Wisconsin. And that's where he first saw a magic show, specifically a trick called the Bloodless Vivisection that seemed reminiscent of sawing a woman in half. So we couldn't resist. Here are Penn and Teller doing just that.
Now, after putting Georgie in a cheap plywood box and filling her beautiful legs with splinters, we put a real heavy steel blade in there. And you all said that Georgie, let it show that she really is separated. We'll then put these blades in here. And there you have it, Georgie and Bernasset, a woman sawn into halves right there. That's Georgie right there.
Is that pretty much what he saw?
Possibly something like that. The vivisection he witnessed was supposedly performed by Dr. Lin. He actually would have witnessed that performance when the Weiss family moved to Milwaukee. And Dr. Lin's vivisection was sort of a combination of what we think of today as the sawing in half, but it was also part of the East Indian rope trick, where somebody's would be severed into many different sections, not just in half. And it turns out that even though Houdini believed he had seen the performance of Dr. Lin, the real Dr. Lin was actually performing in Europe at the time, and so Houdini's hero through most of his life was in fact an impersonator.
So what was it that got his fancy? Do we have any sense of why he was so enlivened by these kind of magic acts?
I think that most people who experience magic are drawn to the power that it has, and then a select few of us are fortunate enough to have a calling to actually try to present that in the world. And when you start performing magic, something that the audience never realizes is that you get to experience the magic by watching them. And so it gets a little addicting when you perform magic, because suddenly you get to take in the wonder that you're fostering in your audience through them. And so you get to have that wonder sent back to you as well.
Well, who wouldn't want to be magic, especially as a kid? You
Absolutely.
Want to do tricks. You want to disappear when you need to. But, of course, this is all about illusion and misdirection. Is that where Houdini excelled, where others did not?
Sure. Well, I mean, once he got interested in escapes, it wasn't as much about illusion. But I think the main connection between magic and escapes is that Houdini was always interested in new inventions and innovations. And both magic and escapes utilize some really intricate and interesting technology and mechanisms. I think Houdini was really drawn to that early in life.
So a tinkerer and a trickster as
exactly,
a kid.
Exactly, yeah.
In fact, he saw the circus as a kid, and his first performance was for folks in the neighborhood while growing up. This was called Eric, Prince of Air.
Yeah, he was inspired by a acrobat he had seen at a circus in Appleton. And even though he was calling himself Prince of the Air, he wasn't actually flying through the air. Although he was performing an impressive feat of flexibility, he would bend over forward, folding himself in half, and pick up a needle from the ground between his teeth.
So one of his first tricks was also called the Little Messenger.
Okay. Sure. So at the time, Houdini landed back in New York, still Eric Weiss, and he's performing as a telegraph messenger boy, and he creates his very first magic trick. It's a small wooden doll, rather crude looking, and he realizes that it's the messenger's job to travel all far distances. So he works on this illusion where this tiny doll disappears and then reappears at an impossible location, usually in a spectator's pocket.
So do we learn any tricks at the Bremen Museum?
We do teach you one trick. We teach you a card trick called the two-card shuffle. It's an amazing trick where two cards change places, sort of reminiscent of the metamorphosis trick that Houdini would become so famous for. I'm not going to tell you how it's done now. You'll have to go to the Bremen
Museum
to learn that.
Yeah. To see it. So this precocious kid, right? And when he was 12 years old, I guess he pulled a different kind of escape trick, that one that probably terrified his family. He actually ran away. And there's a letter in the exhibit back to his mom.
There is, yeah. I like to call it Houdini's first escape. He's 12 years old, living in Milwaukee, and he leaves his mom a note that says, "I'm going to Galveston, Texas, and I'll be back in about a year. My best regards to all, your truant son, Eric." And there he sets off on his own, never makes it to Galveston, but wanders on his own for about a year and then ends up back in New York City and moves in with his father, who's living at a boarding house at the time.
So this is in New York City. This is like deep in the vaudeville and stage show era. And he had to kind of scrape it together. He worked at a necktie factory, apparently, calling himself Houdini, Harry Houdini, King of Cards. What did that name come from?
So he got the name Houdini because he read an autobiography of one of the most famous French magicians of all time, Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin. And he was inspired by Houdin's life and story. And so he decided that he wanted to lead a life just like Houdin. So he adds an I to the end of the name Houdin to be like Houdin. And that's where we get the name Houdini.
So when did he first appear on stage as Harry Houdini? And what was he doing then?
So early on, he was performing in New York around 1893, both as Eric the Great, as well as Harry Houdini, the King of Cards. And he would present a combination of card tricks and other magic effects. Later, he introduces his metamorphosis effect, where he changes place with a colleague locked inside of a trunk. And this was the first time that Houdini would find himself locked in handcuffs on stage.
So the escape tricks sort of started at that point.
Absolutely.
Now, he was discovered, apparently, Martin Beck, is that his name?
Yep.
Suze, he's a vaudeville theater owner, and saw him perform and suggested that he do these escapes. Imitators popped up around that. How did he keep them from stealing his tricks?
Yeah, so Martin Beck required that he stop billing himself as the King of Cards and move to the King of Handcuffs, but he was always a king, of course. And so in order to stop the impersonators who would bill themselves as also the King of Handcuffs and every kind of eenie you can imagine, wee deenie, tee deenie, trentini, Houdini would go to their acts where they, like Houdini did, would accept challenges from the audience for handcuffs to try to get out of. And so Houdini would make handcuffs that were impossible to get out of. He would go to these imitators' acts. He would present them with handcuffs. And when they couldn't get out, which of course they couldn't, he would jump up and say, "I am Houdini, the only real King of Handcuffs." And by 1908, there were so many Houdini impersonators that Houdini took the handcuff escape out of his act. And to prevent anyone else from making money from the act, he published a book revealing all of his methods.
I'm speaking with magician David London, who curated the new Houdini exhibition at the Bremen in Atlanta. It's up until August 11th. All right, so he did come up with one imitation-proof trick, or this was at least the attempt. We heard him introduce this water torture tank. Someone would put his hands and feet into manacles, then he would be lowered headfirst into a water tank with a glass front. The 2006 Christopher Nolan movie The Prestige pays a little bit of an homage to this tank.
If you would tie her wrists, bind her feet around the ankle,
so the woman in the movie, she didn't make it. But Harry Houdini always got out before the, 3 minutes it would take for a regular human being to drown?
Yeah, and actually, sometimes he would never let his audiences witness his escape. He'd always cover the tank with a curtain. And sometimes he would make the audience wait up to 6 minutes before he appeared from behind the curtain. But I believe that he probably got out in less than a minute and was just hanging out waiting for the tension to build to its ultimate level before he reappeared.
So he didn't necessarily have those drums playing, as we heard in the movie. How did he build the tension?
Probably not. I mean, he would challenge the audience to try to hold their breath for as long as he did. And I know 6 minutes seems like a long time, but the one most difficult escape he ever challenged, he got challenged by the Daily Mirror newspaper to escape from a pair of handcuffs that the best locksmith in London had spent years making. And Houdini did get out of them, but it took him over 3 hours to do so.
Did he ever come close to death in any of his tricks?
So the one time that he nearly died, somebody challenged him to escape out of the belly of a sea monster. Most likely this was a whale that washed up on the shore. They dragged the whale to the theater. He was locked in handcuffs and sewn inside the whale. And that was the one time he nearly died, not because he couldn't escape, but because the toxic fumes from inside the rotting whale nearly suffocated him.
I can imagine.
I can't.
His straitjacket escape often landed him on the front page. In fact, he sometimes would do it right in front of newspaper offices and pulled off the feat just as movie technology was coming onto the scene. So these movies were initially silent, of course. Phantasma Magic posted this version with a little bit of sound. So, David, what's happening during this trick?
So probably what's happening is that at this moment, Houdini is getting locked up in the straitjacket, usually done by police officials. He'll soon be hoisted by his ankles into the air, almost always suspended from the local newspaper building. Sometimes crowds of 50,000 people would gather below to watch him escape. And then over the next 2 minutes, he'll maneuver his body to actually get out of the straitjacket itself.
So he was a master of deception. This is after the First World War. Millions of people died, and those who promised to contact the dead started popping up all over the place. Mm-hmm. What was his thinking about?
Yeah, so this was the second rise of spiritualism in America, the first one being shortly after the Civil War, both times being after major wars where many numbers of Americans had lost their loved ones, and so they were desperately looking for ways to be able to hold on or make contact with those they had lost at war. And even though Houdini had studied deception for his entire life, it was the fact that he was so well trained in the techniques of deception that allowed him to see through the methods that these fraudulent spirit mediums were using. So he started holding public lectures in every city he would visit. He incorporated the exposure of these mediums into his act because he saw a big difference between using trickery for entertainment and trickery to take advantage of the weak.
How about his eventual death? This is something that sounds like an urban legend almost. What happened?
It was not. Yeah. So a lot of people believe the story of his death that was portrayed in the Tony Curtis Houdini movie in the 1950s. But that actually paints a completely false picture of what happened. One of the feats of strength Houdini would present throughout his career is he was able to prepare his mind and body to be able to take a punch from even the strongest boxer. And he's performing up in Canada, and a college student from McGill University approaches him and asks if he can take any punch. And he says yes while he's backstage reading his mail, and the student starts punching him over and over and over again. He's in a great deal of pain, but doesn't go to the doctor and continues to perform, finishes his run up in Canada, makes it back to America to perform in Detroit, and on the very first night of his run in Detroit, he collapses on stage. And it's discovered that he had been suffering from appendicitis, and that punch had actually ruptured his appendix. Oh. And so he actually starts to suffer from septic poisoning. That is the cause of the extreme pain, and that eventually leads to his demise.
Houdini, what a legacy he left behind. I mean, this show at the Bremen is just one of many. There are books, there are exhibitions, there's so much fascination with Houdini. You know, we have these magicians and tricksters and escape artists. You know, I remember when I was growing up, Doug Henning making the Statue of Liberty disappear. Yeah. Why is Houdini still the one that people say he's no Houdini or he escapes like Houdini?
Yeah, so I really believe that Houdini was only able to become Houdini at the exact moment that he became Houdini. It was the perfect confluence of timing, new technologies out in the world. The idea of global celebrity was a new concept. Long distance travel became possible. Long distance communication became possible. New technologies and new media made it possible for somebody to really have have their image and their story shared around the world, and he embraced all of those things.
What did these kind of shows mean to people at that time?
Yeah, so beyond just entertainment, I think that Houdini's real power was that he sort of became this metaphorical creature. Every time that he would encounter a challenge or attempt an escape, he would sort of live out the inherent human drama that we all go through in our lives. We encounter a challenge, we accept the challenge, we assess it, we tackle it head on, oftentimes or sometimes with great difficulty, and then we overcome. And so each time Houdini was able to escape, he really captured the public's imagination because they were sort of reaffirmed in their own ability to get out of situations which seemed seemingly impossible to get out of.
If he can get out of the water torture cell, you can get out of your drudgery.
I suppose, yeah.
Okay, we did mention that he spent years trying to debunk spiritualists and mediums, but he did actually believe one may be able to reach the dead. In fact, he thought he might pull it off himself from the grave. How did he set this up?
Well, I mean, Houdini believed that if anyone would be able to escape death, it would be Houdini, of course. So before he died, he set up a secret code with his wife, and she agreed to hold a seance for him on the anniversary of his death each year. She did so for 10 years, was unable to do so. The tradition has continued for 91 years now. And other people try to contact him. Every year, there's an official Houdini seance held on Halloween. The last one was held in Baltimore last year, which I got to attend, as well as the previous one in Cleveland. To this point, 91 years later, though, Houdini has been unable to make contact, but fingers crossed, maybe next year.
So if you were to get a message or have a conversation with Houdini from beyond, what would you want to know from him?
I would like to tell him something, actually. I would like to be able to tell him that he is still famous. And I would love to be able to get into his mind and figure out really what drove him to create Houdini. And I think this is the important part of the story, is that Eric Weiss created this larger-than-life persona that still lingers in the public imagination. And I really just love to understand the inner workings of his mind and try to understand how exactly he made that happen.
Well, we learn a lot more about it at the Bremen. And David, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David London, he's curator of a new Houdini exhibit at Atlanta's Bremen Museum and is running through August 11th. There's more information at gpbnews.org. That is it for today. On Second Thought is produced by Amelia Brock, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Jesse Neiswanger is our engineer. Don Smith, our dean of grammar. Amy Kiley is senior producer. And Sarah Shariari is managing editor for GPB News. We invite your comments, questions, and civil complaints at our Facebook group, GPB Radio On Second Thought. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for listening to On Second Thought.